We are deeply conditioned by this ethos that doing lots of things is kind of an inherent good.
Busyness without satisfaction is a malady of epidemic proportions.
We do a lot of things, often masquerading as productivity techniques, mainly to make ourselves feel like little gods over our time. Time is going to win the battle in the end.
So, there is a solution to your problem and the chronic stress and anxiety that it gives rise to.
I've done 100 of these, supposedly silver bullets for living a happy and accomplished life. Maybe the problem here is not going to be solved by the 101st. Maybe the problem is looking for a silver bullet.
Pay attention carefully because I think it might just change your life. Really quick, you guys, I keep hearing from fans of the show that they don't always see our episodes in their feed. And when I tried to figure out why, I discovered one important reason. 71% of you who watch here on YouTube are not subscribed yet. So could you do me a tiny favor? Just hit subscribe. It's free. It'll take you 1 second. And that way you won't miss any of the episodes that I post here on YouTube. Thank you. And on to the show. Well, I'm very excited to talk to you today. Thank you for coming all the way out here, Oliver, because I think your work, as I said to you.
Now back to the podcast. But before, did you know only 1 in 5 listeners finishes an episode? That's why we summarize your favorite podcasts. Visit our website to learn more.
Before the podcast started, it's just so vital. It gets at the heart of this dilemma, conundrum, disease, whatever you want to call it, that goes to the very center of what it means to inhabit a human body in the modern world, really. You know, it's like this experience, this failed attempt that we're all making to manage our lives based upon this diluted understanding of how time works and what it means to live a meaningful life. And all it does is create this constant, perpetual state of anxiety, exhaustion, irritability, impatience, and general discontentment. And I would say, just from a personal standpoint, you know, this is my biggest malfunction. I'm living a life well beyond anything I could have ever imagined for myself. And yet I struggle in my ability to enjoy it. I feel so burdened by responsibilities and my inability to keep up with the demands that are placed upon me. And of course, as you write about, like, I'm projecting some idealized future self who's going to be able to enjoy all of this, right?
Yeah,
while my life is sort of passing by in the interim. And I know that, you know, I'm not alone in this. And this is the dilemma, the core dilemma that you've essentially devoted your life to resolving for all of us, which is a tremendous act of public service.
Thank you very much. Or not resolving, but sort of really living into the irresolvability of it, maybe.
Well, maybe we can start with our broken relationship with, as a theory of mine, I think so much of our human dysfunction really boils down to this misunderstanding of how time works and our relationship with it that drives our decision-making and our behaviors and this general sense of discontentment.
Yeah, a lot of it comes down to time, or you can just say we live in time, right? It's the stuff of our lives. So anything that we're doing wrong that's increasing our suffering is going to manifest in that way. I guess one of the ways of seeing it is just this basic idea that time is something you have, right? That you're in a relationship to time. I think that's kind of the cause of all the problems in a way, because we start off with this idea that we've got this resource and we've got to make the most use of it and we want to control how it unfolds. And there's something about all of that that is not true to the situation that we're actually in, which is that, all you ever have is the actual moment that you're in. You don't really get to control. You can't put time aside for later. You have very, very partial control over how time unfolds, even in your own little corner of the world. And yeah, like, time is going to win the battle in the end, right? So I think we're constantly trying to do things to make ourselves feel like little gods over our time and not sort of, and I think it leads to all sorts of, I think that is the source of like all sorts of action problems, you know, procrastination, distraction, all the rest of it. A lot of it can be understood as ways of trying to feel less limited.
Fundamentally, we have an insane notion when it comes to our, you know, what we think we're able to control and not control. We're much more prone to believe that we have a greater degree of control over our lives and external events than we do. And that's sort of at the foundational level, right? And so with that sense of control that we're never able to quite master, we're constantly disappointed by our failed attempts to control external events and even our own emotions. This just seems to lead us towards a deeper desire to control rather than an honest appraisal of our lack of control and the natural uncertainty of the world. That leads us to just, you know, hold on even tighter rather than release the reins, which is, you know, a central tenet of your message.
Yeah, totally. I mean, just like a really obvious simple example is like overwhelm, right? Everyone feels like they've got too much to do, or pretty much everyone. So you try to find ways to do more of it, which is either clever systems or like extra self-discipline or something. And you never get to the point of being able to do all the things by definition, because the space of things that feel like they need doing is...
But we still believe it's possible.
Basically infinite. Right. Yeah. You're constantly chasing it. Technologies kind of hold out this amazing promise, right? That's like, with this device or with this system, you know, you're going to be able to do more and more of it. But those technologies also bring
us... foments more of it.
More and more of it to do.
Right.
Remember like the inbox zero movement for a while?
Totally.
And, you know, all that did was, you know, precipitate a great deal of like shame and guilt and, you know, a lack of self-compassion.
Right. No, I agree. Because, you know, like... It's kind of obvious when you think about it that if you start answering emails at a much quicker tempo than before in order to get through all your emails, you're going to get a lot more replies to your replies more quickly. And then you're going to get a reputation in your organization for being really responsive on email. So more people are going to email you. And like the whole, all else being equal, if you try to optimize yourself with respect to some effectively infinite stream of inputs, you're just going to get busier. You're not going to get that control that we feel we need. I sometimes think it's, including in the book, I kind of think it's really interesting to make this comparison with like people from a long, long time ago, like what it would have been like to live in medieval England or something, and to just from the beginning have no thought that you could control whether war or famine or plague was going to obliterate everything in your life, like within a month. There's something very modern about the fact that we have all these technologies that kind of lead us to believe that it ought to be doable. So we constantly feel like we're almost there, like just one more productivity system or just six more months of getting my habits in order. And like, then I'll get to that bit where it's all plain sailing.
It's premised upon this idea that we should be productive. Productivity is good. And our value is calibrated based upon our ability to be as productive as possible. And one of the things that you talk about is this idea that productivity is not a moral imperative. So tease that out a little bit.
Well, right. I mean, it's just we are deeply conditioned, I think, by this ethos that doing lots of things is kind of an inherent good, like the doing of as many things as you can. And if you can get through more of the things, then that's somehow better and you should feel better about yourself. Just stating it like that, it's obviously clear that, right, it depends on what the things are. There are plenty of people in the world who we might wish to do fewer of the things that they're doing. You know, it's like, well, it'd be a better place with certain people not doing the things that they're doing. And for ourselves, we're in this constant kind of tangle where our self-worth is totally wrapped up in this, because you start to feel that it's only if you kind of do enough stuff that you get to feel good about yourself.
Before diving into the principles of a done list versus a to-do list, it's vital to grasp the conversation around overcoming perfectionism and recognizing limitations. As the discussion progresses, listeners will explore how embracing these limitations can actually fuel productivity and self-confidence. Can adopting a more forgiving approach to our tasks change the way we perceive our accomplishments?
I can decide to do these things. And that too got things flowing again in the writing context.
The idea of the done list being as distinct from the to-do list as a generative kind of process. It's additive, like you want to include things and you kind of engender self-confidence by growing that done list as opposed to the growing to-do list that never gets done and starts to make you feel bad.
Right, right. And the to-do list is always like your judgment of your productivity with the to-do list is always in comparison to all the things left to do, which right. is like, and in general, comparing yourself to an infinite yardstick is a bad way to feel.
Well, there's also the thing where you make the to-do list and there's something in the brain that makes that sort of feels like you accomplished the task just because you wrote it on a list
yeah.
of something that you need to do, yeah. even though you never
yeah.
do it.
Yeah, right. No, absolutely. Yeah. No, I mean, we play all sorts of tricks on ourselves to feel like that moment of control is coming soon. And one of the great things that some people find with done lists is that if you find yourself in a sort of really low motivational moment, right, a sort of a really sort of in a rut with things, you can start off making a done list with things like tasks too so low level that you wouldn't ever want to admit to anyone else mm-hmm. that you'd put them on a done list, right? You can say took shower, made coffee, right, and even that little bit of consciousness of your own efficacy in the world can very quickly snowball so that you're back to, you know, being a functional. Yeah.
One of the things you talk about is the mystical energy that's produced by completion, like just completing something, mm-hmm. To use the word again, is generative, like it contributes yeah. energy to you. Whereas perfectionism, you know, leads to incompleted things or delaying completion that becomes an emotional drain.
Yeah, right. And then, yes, perfectionism is always holding out for more or trying to do more things. Multitasking, I think, ultimately is an attempt to feel like you're more in control of like all the projects than you really are. So completing things does take this kind of, the same kind of anxiety tolerance or something mm-hmm. that is in the background a lot what we're talking about here, I think. You have to be like, I know there's lots of other things I on some level should be doing, but what I'm going to be doing is finishing this one, moving it off, going to the next one. And of course, with a huge project, you're going to be talking about a sub
yeah.
section of it. I don't mean writing a book or redesigning a house as a single step, but the idea that you're deciding to take it on, to make all the other things wait, to bring this to completion and then to move it on to the next thing. As you say, like you'd have thought that would take a lot more energy and stamina, but it kindles it. It releases it. And my sort of non-scientific theory for why that should be is just that it's because we're sort of falling in line with reality at that point. We're fitting ourselves into the grooves of mm-hmm. of how time really works for us, which is that we do act sequentially. We're acting sequentially even when we think we're multitasking, right? So we don't act in parallel like we wish.
One of the things that I constantly confront is trying to arrange my schedule and my life to, you know, create these moments and opportunities where, like, for example, I'm writing a book right now and, you know, my life's very busy and I have this day gig. And so when I can block out some time to finally sit down and focus on this one thing, the stakes are suddenly very high because
yeah.
it's like, oh, I have to make this much progress. It brings up the perfectionism and the, and this, you know, sense that there isn't enough time. And of course that just creates constraint. That's at cross purposes with you being able to do your best work. And then of course there's all the uninvited interruptions because life has a way of right. intervening on, you know, those moments, despite, you know, your sense that you're controlling the universe mm-hmm. and setting everything up to be perfect.
Yeah, no, completely. It's and the high stakes thing really speaks to me. I think that's there is this phenomenon, isn't there, whereby the more success that we have in scheduling our time, right? So even as you get better at this, and as you also have the autonomy to make your life look like how you want, and so you implement that, somehow the worse it gets. That feeling that like I've got this 90 minutes for mm-hmm. for this thing. And this is part of a broader situation where like success is not an antidote to any of this stuff, because if anything, success just means that the things you're choosing between it's more painful to say no to things because mm-hmm. you're getting more interesting opportunities. Or right, there are 10 wonderful things you could be doing with that 90 minutes. And if you don't use it properly for the thing you've deemed it for, then it's more of a failure because of all the things you're missing out on. So yeah, it's important to see that like none of this is about finally reaching a place on the ladder of success where it goes away. It's, if anything, the opposite.
All of it is premised upon this investment that we're making in our future selves and this idealized version of what our life is going to be like if we can just sit down and focus and be productive in what it is that we have to accomplish today, right?
Yeah.
And one of the things that you talk about and one of the practices that you advocate for is this idea of like, stop being so kind to your future self. Like your life is happening right now. That's right. All we have. Like yeah. This is, you know, on the subject of reality, accepting reality, like this present moment, this exchange that we're having, right? This is all that there is. And everything else is a narrative. It's a story that we've constructed.
Yeah.
And true productivity and everything that eludes us, meaning, fulfillment, satisfaction, purpose, it's all available to us in stillness. And yet this is the one thing that, you know, we resist the most.
Yeah, no, really well put. I think there's something really intense about being present, about accepting that like this is real life. This is as real as any of your life is going to get. There's something that feels kind of, yeah, it feels unpleasantly vulnerable. And there's something self-protective about the idea that like this is all just preparation for the time mm-hmm. later on when I really step into my own, which, you know, in my experience is it's one thing to believe that when you're 20 and as you move through the decades, it becomes less and less plausible that the moment of truth is still.
Well, life is rigged this way. It's like we go to school and it's like get good grades so you can get into this school and it's like everything is based upon setting you up for the future.
Yeah.
And so how do you then, you know, deprogram yourself from that hard wiring.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think it really is, for me anyway, it's just been a question of just very gently leading oneself back again and again to this truth. So the future you stuff is very interesting because, of course, there are people, right, who you might look at their lives and say, you need to spend a bit more, think a bit more about what this is going to mean for the future. And people who sort of live in a very sort of hedonistic way. But almost anybody who's interested in this stuff in the first place, right, who has an interest in personal development or anything, is almost certainly going to be already perhaps too good at the deferring of gratification that, as you say, we're culturally, is culturally reinforced at every stage. And you can defer gratification too much. Like, you definitely can put off the moment where you kind of claim happiness and enjoyment in life to a point where, like, you're making a bad decision.
In the preceding discussion, the exploration of marshmallow experiments highlighted the complexities of delayed gratification and how interruptions can reshape our relationship with time. As these insights resonate, the conversation now shifts to the power of storytelling and how confronting our embedded narratives can open paths to self-discovery. What transformative realizations await as they delve deeper into the art of rewriting our personal stories?
So, how do you think about that aspect of this?
I think that's really true. I think a lot of the power is, people talk about like telling different stories or rewriting stories, but I think an awful lot of the benefit just comes from seeing that stories is what they are, right? And that sort of process of disidentifying from the agendas that we're raised with and understanding a little bit about what might be the ulterior motives behind them. I've often found that like that's where the personal inner work comes, right? It's like, it's not so much that I then have to rigorously construct a different story. It's just understanding that like, oh, right, yes, you get free of it in that moment. I have, like many, many people, I have a sort of morning pages practice, right? It's the one thing I've found myself actually doing consistently for decades now. And I really think the main benefit of that is like, I write about the stuff that's bugging me or that I'm struggling with, and then by definition, in the process of writing about it, it's no longer...
You've purged your stuff
well,
of it.
Yeah, there's the catharsis side of it.
Hours.
No, definitely that is a part of it, but I'm more getting at like, like, it's no longer the water I swim in. Like, it's there on the page. I've got like a third party relationship to it. And, you know, I might still believe it or be bothered by it, but I'm no longer just seeing through. It's not like, you know, glasses that I'm looking through. It's like I'm looking at the glasses instead. And there's a degree of freedom from it in that. And
detach or disidentify.
Right. And then maybe choose to follow some of its logic and maybe not, but have some choice in the matter.
What do you say to the person who's listening to this or watching, who's thinking, it must be nice, Oliver. Like, you get to wake up and do your morning pages and write your books. And, you know, that's all grand, but you don't understand my life, the complexity of my life. I've got two jobs and I'm a single parent. And I, you know, this all sounds fantastic, but also quite privileged. Like, I have burdens and obligations you can't imagine just to put food on the table. Mm-hmm. On some level, like, you know, I appreciate that. Like, you know, life is much harder for most people than it is for you or I. Mm-hmm. But on some level also, like, this is at the heart of productivity. Like, how do you manage like a very difficult to manage life?
No, I think it's a really good point. I think it is fundamentally just like a different point as opposed to a contradictory point, right? That on the one hand, there are all these forms of suffering that are relative, that some people suffer far more than others because of their socioeconomic good fortune or bad fortune and demographic and all sorts of things. And then there are these kind of timeless issues that affect us all in one way or another. Mm-hmm. So not being able to do everything, being finite, having to make tough choices with time, that's everybody. When you lay them over each other, then obviously, yes, you're going to get people whose terrible, difficult dilemma is which of three amazing business opportunities to pursue. And somebody else's terrible dilemma is like whether they're going to like keep their job or get to be a halfway present parent for their kid, right? It's a much more agonizing situation. And it's definitely a harder thing. But it has the same structure, and it's quite surprising how agonizing it can feel, even to sort of address the more privileged versions of it. So I'm constantly running into these this strange territory in what I write about, where there are things I'm writing about where I think I'm making claims that are really easy for me to say in a certain way, and also true, which is an awkward space to be in, right? So definitely when I'm picking examples to give and illustrate things, I might pick one with more or coming from an example of more or lesser privilege. And I'm definitely very, very grateful for all the dilemmas I don't have to face in my life. But these are like deep existential human things that we all have to cope with. I guess one other thing you could say about that is that even when it feels like you've got no room for maneuver in your actual external life, like you don't have the autonomy to only do a certain number of hours work in the day or to spend more time doing something more creative or something, there's a real psychological benefit in seeing the truth of your situation, right? In not being in that mode, like in seeing that you're not, in not collaborating with this societal ethos that if you just put a bit more self-discipline in or organized your time better, you'd be able to do everything. Like if impossible tasks, if life is asking impossible things of you, it's really helpful to see that that's impossible and that all you can actually do is choose some of them, even if it doesn't lead to any great transformations in like what your life looks like from the outside. You have stepped back into your power in an important way there, I think.
I think of your work as a bit of a Trojan horse. It's draped with everything the reader wants to see in the context of a how-to self-help book about productivity, right? Like that's how you're bringing people in. But inside this Trojan horse is really a path towards self-actualization. Like this is like how to live a better, more meaningful life. And as much as there are practical things to do and guidance and advice about decision-making and you know, how to be ultimately your most productive over the long haul of your life, it's really like, I look at it as this devotional practice of honoring yourself in every moment. Like how can you make better decisions, not to achieve some external goal, but so that you can be in greater alignment with your values. Mm-hmm. And, you know, how can you make sure that you're resting as just, you know, reverence for your physical body? And how can you be present enough so that you can serve the moment? Like, these are all concepts that, you know, are kind of higher up the Maslow's hierarchy of needs than like how to be more productive so you can be better at your job and get a promotion.
Yes, I think you're right. I think calling it a Trojan horse makes it look like it's been more strategic and deliberate than it has been. I think you're right that that's how it's ended up. But really, that has resulted from my own journey as someone who's kind of really wanted those productivity techniques and really wanted that system. And I don't know, had the, I don't know what the skill is, the perseverance or stubbornness or something to keep being dissatisfied with not having found it. And then you get to the point where you see what it's really about. And I think the devotional idea is beautiful there, because it really is this kind of, I keep coming back to the idea that ultimately it's not a set of techniques. It's definitely not something you can sort of install in your brain and then you're good to go. At the end of the book, I even point out that the subtitle of the book, the idea that you're going to deal with this all in 4 weeks is kind of a bait and switch. But it's actually, instead, it's something that it is really helpful to sort of marinate in this kind of perspective.
It's a way of being.
Right, right. And to have, so the idea in the book is that you're going to give it a few minutes maybe every day for a month. But even in just how I experience it in my own life, it's like coming back to it, journaling about it, reading other books that are in a similar vein, not with any sense that I'm finally going to find the technique that means I don't have to think about it anymore. Because even that desire to get to the point where you don't really have to think about it is like antithetical to what I'm talking about here, which is like, no, we're in it. This is it.
Yeah.
It's always going to be it.
Yeah. I mean, the whole notion of productivity on some level presumes the idea that you can control your life.
Right.
And your work is like, well, guess what? You can't. Sorry. Life is messy. It's always going to be uncertain. So everything you ever thought about, like how you were going to be able to achieve that, like toss that out the window. And here's a better way of being in relationship with yourself and the world that acknowledges the messiness and the uncertainty of everything.
Understanding the quest for agency and the balance between acceptance and productivity sets the stage for exploring the optimization movement. As the conversation unfolds, the speakers delve into the allure of self-improvement protocols and question their true purpose. Could it be more about control than genuine fulfillment?
Set of steps that you practice religiously that are going to move your life forward or change or change your life. So what is your perspective on this optimization movement that you see, you know, if you just canvas the internet?
Yeah, I think that, I mean, I understand the appeal, right? Because it is the purest form in a way of the promise of control. It's like, do these things and everything else follows, because you're picking what matters and reorganizing your life according to those things. I mean, I've written about this quite a bit in the past, but like, I think the basic problem with optimization of any kind is that the question is always like, optimization for what?
For what?
And if all you're doing is making yourself a better system for processing throughput, then all else being equal, you're just going to be busier and probably make worse decisions about what to bring in to your realm, because you think you can do all of it. So you end up focusing on all sorts of stuff that you didn't care about. I mean, it's hard for me not to look at a lot of this, including like some of the extremes of the kind of longevity stuff as well.
I mean, that was just my follow-up, like health span extension. Right, that is the extreme version of
this. And none of these things are inherently bad. It's not inherently bad to make your, like, if it takes you an hour to find your clothes in the morning, you probably need some more efficiency in how your home is organized. Sure. What it's not going to do is get you to the point of total fulfillment in life by just continuing that logic through the rest of your life. And the same with health span. Like, I mean, yeah, I'm not going to sit here and say it's bad to do things that mean you have a longer, healthier, enjoyable life to live. But I've got to believe that in at least some people's cases, and I think sometimes some of the luminaries of the space have been quite honest about this as well, right? That there is going on there an attempt to sort of not literally intellectually live for it. No, everyone knows it's life is finite, but to sort of feel oneself not in the position of being on a glide path towards death. And like, that should not stop anybody from eating more nutritiously instead of less nutritiously.
Yeah.
But it's like, what's it for? What it's for is hopefully that both the activity of doing it itself, ideally, and the energy and focus and extra time to which it might lead are opportunities to be more present in this finite life, mm-hmm. rather than part of some plan to achieve escape velocity.
Yeah, it's about what's driving it, what the motivation is. If your motivation behind health span extension, whether you're aware of it or not, is because you have this, you know, deep distaste for the idea that one day you might die, you know, or just a discomfort with uncertainty or reckoning with your inability to, you know, be able to control externalities. That's a dysfunctional relationship,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Obviously, we all want to live as long and be as vital in our lives as we possibly can. But why do we want that? So that we can experience the richness of what life has to offer. So if your focus on health span extension or any other kind of optimization protocol in your life is purely for the purpose of mastering the protocol or because it sates some innate desire within you to feel like you're in control, then you're off the mark. Now, it's like these things are all great, but if your rules around, you know, sleep and nutrition are so strict that you no longer have friends and you can't be in a relationship or you're unbendable in every regard, like you're missing the entire point of the whole thing.
Yeah, no, totally. It's a question of knowing why you're doing it. And even then, right, you can, maybe your enjoyment is mastering certain protocols, right? That's not a problem, but know that that's what you're doing and that it's taking away time from other things that you're choosing to neglect instead. Again, it's always about like becoming more conscious of what's going on rather than necessarily changing what one is doing.
If you had to choose one major misconception that people have around productivity in the context of living a meaningful life, is there one that comes top of mind?
I mean, I guess it's just this notion of living for the future, right? I don't know that it's a misconception or if it's just a sort of way of an orientation towards life that we slip into all too easily, but it's that basic idea that in some way this moment right here is a bit provisional relative to the one that's coming later. And I still get flashes of this in myself, right? Anything that I'm absolutely perfect at, but it's this idea that the real reason that you're doing anything is for when it cashes out in a portion of life that's coming later. Of course, we're pursuing long-term goals. Of course, there are things we're creating in the hopes that at a later point, we reap the rewards in this way or that. But there's got to be some role for enjoying or finding meaning in the doing of it. And otherwise, you end up in this this place. There's this great quote that I used in 4,000 Weeks from John Maynard Keynes, The Economist, where he talks about people being stuck in this mindset where the guy who's stuck in this mindset doesn't love his cat, but only the cat's kittens, and not really even the cat's kittens, but the kitten's kittens, and like so on forward forever. That's no way to live.
Is that one of the reasons why you have this practice of scruffy generosity? Is that a way of like rooting your life in the present moment?
I really think it is. Yeah, scruffy hospitality is this phrase that an Anglican pastor from Tennessee called Jack King coined. And it's really just the whole idea of like bringing people into your home. It's not just about dinner parties, right? But that's where it started. Doing things in the world in a way where you're sort of like being open and honest about the kind of mess. So he talks about how he and his wife had this, they loved having people for dinner, but they had developed this like checklist of things that had to be put in place until everything was perfect so that the guests would be really impressed. And it ended up putting them off actually doing it because it's so much work.
You never, because you know, it was never clean enough. So then obviously no dinner parties.
Right. And so I'm deliberately making this conscious decision to be like, do you want to say to friends, like, do you want to come around? The house is going to be how it is. We're going to cook things based on what's in the cupboard. And discovering, and I have the same experience, I think, not just that it's okay and that people will forgive you for like making a less impressive meal than you might have done, but that there's actually something actively positive and kind of better in a way about the connection that comes from letting these facades fall and just being like, you know, this is who I am and this is what my life is. I'm really interested in this. I don't know if this resonates with you in your professional role, but like I have the sense that people are just completely voracious online for like behind the scenes stuff. They want to know like how you put this podcast together as much as they want to know what happens once the podcast is happening. And all that kind of that same idea, there's this kind of great hunger for like, no, what's the reality? Mm. And I think there's just a desire to, there's a closeness and a sense of connection. It might be parasocial in the case of lots of internet stuff, but when it comes to like inviting people around to your house, there's a real closeness that comes from like, you know, this is how I am, right. And you know that it's how you are too. You know your house is in a mess too sometimes, right? So like we're giving
the
each
unvarnished
other
reality.
We're giving
like
each other
relaxing into that. Like it's like being okay with yourself in all of your imperfections.
That's all for today. Visit podsummarizer.xyz and start creating summaries of your own podcast in just seconds. Don't miss it.